Let's get started on another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word. We are in Deuteronomy chapter 16, which is Moses' final address to the people of Israel, and he is doing a big review of all the law and case law and principles that God has given him as Israel's prophet to pass on to the people. And he knows that he's only got this last little bit of his life left to cram this material into the heads of the Israelis that are going to go into the promised land. And they're supposed to be living by these rules. So it's very, very important to him that they hear it one more time, and then he's going to make sure it gets written down to follow them into the promised land. So as you expect, it's a mixture of information as we go through here. Verse 21 of Deuteronomy 16 says, "You shall not plant any tree as an Asherah beside the altar of he who is your God that you shall make." Now, Asherah is a worship object that is devoted to the Canaanite goddess of fertility, the goddess of the soil, the goddess of the sky, actually, too, the goddess of grain. And she was very often tied to the idea of wood. So a tree could be devoted to her, and that's what the Asherah would be about. It's possible that something similar to what we think of when we say totem pole might have also been devoted to her. And the rule that's given here is don't you dare put this sort of pagan object of worship next to God's altar. Now, it is shameful that this is prophetically tagging an event later in Israeli history. In the latter years of the temple, the first temple we're talking about here, before it was destroyed in 587 BC, we know for a fact that an Asherah pole or an Asherah tree was placed inside the temple courtyard near the temple building. And it is mentioned in some of the prophetic books of that time as kind of the last straw before God's judgment fell and the temple was destroyed in 587 BC. So here's the warning, don't do that. But they did it anyway. Verse 22, "You shall not set up a pillar which he who is your God hates." Now, the pillar here is probably more of a reference to a stone marker. And stone was often connected with the partner goddess or partner god to Asherah. This would be Baal of the Canaanite pantheon. And so they would put up these stones in worship of Baal, the thunder and lightning god of the sky. And so in verses 21 and 22, God is basically having Moses remind the Israelis, don't you dare be setting up wood and stone markers that are devoted to the power couple of the pagan religion, Baal and Ishtar, or Asherah. Don't you do it. Verse 1 of chapter 17. Then we shift again. "You shall not sacrifice to he who is your God an ox or a sheep in which is a blemish, any defect whatsoever, for that is an abomination to he who is your God." So the reminder, which we'd actually seen not too long ago, all sacrificial animals must be perfect in their body, meaning there can't be open wounds, there can't be scars, there can't be legs missing, there can't be limping of the animal, they can't be blind, they can't even have cataracts. They have to be perfectly healthy and whole. And if you try to offer something that's not, you are insulting God. And that's really part of the point of the book of Malachi. The part where God says, you're offering to me the lame and the blind? Why don't you try to offer that to your human governor and see where that gets you? So here is the beginning of the warning of that bad attitude. Verse number 2. Another little shift. If there is found among you within any of your towns that he who is your God is giving you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of he who is your God in transgressing his covenant, and he has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, or the sun, or the moon, or any of the host of heaven, which I've forbidden, and it is told you, and you hear of it, then you shall inquire diligently, which means you make an investigation. And if it is true and certain that such an abomination has been done in Israel, then you shall bring out to your gates that man or woman who has done this evil thing, and you shall stone that man or woman to death with stones. So Israel was to be the only theocracy that has genuinely existed on planet Earth in its history. There have been some claim that idea, but Israel is the only one that was specifically directed by God to be a theocracy. And as a theocracy, only God was to be worshipped as the king of Israel and of the universe, as the creator. If you worshipped other gods and goddesses, then you were a traitor to God. If you encouraged others to worship other gods and goddesses, then you were encouraging rebellion against the king of Israel. And so that is a capital crime. And in the other passages, the reminder is, you can't have pity on people who engage in such rebellion, such sedition against the true king of Israel, against God himself. They have to be executed. Even if they are your best friend, even if they are the love of your life, even if they are your own child or your own parent, this cannot be tolerated. It has to be nipped in the bud. Now, again, this is something put in place by Moses according to God's direction, but it was not practiced as faithfully as it should have been. And so we have big-time problems with the worship of other gods and goddesses throughout Israel's history. Now, verse 6, still on this same topic, lays down some principles about execution of those who have committed capital crimes, such as rebellion against King God. Verse 6, on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one person. He said, she said, does not fly in the court of law. There have to be independent witnesses to the crime. And that is true for blasphemy or for the worship of other gods and goddesses, of murder, theft, things of that nature. And so you have to have a multitude, two or three, at the minimum, independent witnesses to the crime. Otherwise, there will be no death penalty put in place. However, if there are two or three witnesses of the crime and the death penalty is invoked, then verse 7 is triggered. The hand of the witnesses shall be first against him to put him to death, and then afterward the hand of all the people, and so you shall purge the evil from your midst. Execution in the land of Israel was to be participatory. The witnesses that gave the condemning testimony had to be the first participants in the execution. The intention, no doubt, was to add a chilling effect to the idea of bearing false witness against someone to get them killed. Because if you're the one that actually has to do the killing, the execution of someone, hopefully you've got enough humanity in you that you would think twice about that if you're the one that had to carry out the penalty. But notice that once the witnesses began the process, which is stoning in this case, then other members of the society were supposed to join in, because justice is carried out by the community. Vengeance is done by an individual, but justice is done by the community. That's the difference. Verse number 8. If any case arises requiring decision between one kind of homicide and another, such as the difference between manslaughter and premeditated murder, one kind of legal right and another, or one kind of assault and another, any case within your towns that is too difficult for you, then you shall arise and go up to the place that he who is your God will choose. Now, this piggybacks on something we already know from Moses giving of law earlier. There are to be multiple levels of judges that are to try to solve difficulties between people at the lowest possible level. So you've got judges that are supposed to be looking over the affairs of 10 families. And then above that, you have judges that are looking over the affairs of 50 families. And then above that, you've got judges looking over the affairs of 100 families. And then above that is 1,000 families. And so whatever the guy that's looking after 10 families can't sort out, he bumps up to the 50 guy. The ones that he can't sort out, he bumps up to the 100 family guy. And the ones he can't sort out, he bumps up to the 1,000 family guy. But ultimately, the final place of appeal is the high priest. Take it before God himself, if it can't be resolved at these lower levels. I think a very wise way of doing things. It was first suggested to Moses by his father-in-law, Reuel, Jethro, but it was not until Moses had a little bitty near collapse of his psyche right after they left Mount Sinai that God said, okay, Moses, you need to put this thing into practice. You need to have these multiple levels of people carrying out justice, carrying out adherence to the law. And then whatever can't be resolved in those different levels will come before me through the high priest. Verse number 9, and you shall come to the Levitical priests and to the judge who is in office in those days. This is, I think, maybe the first time we've heard about the judge that's going to be overseeing the non-Levitical side of justice. The judge becomes kind of the governmental leader at different periods of time, eventually will be replaced by the king. So you're supposed to come to the religious leadership and to the leadership of the nation, and you shall consult them, and they shall declare to you the decision. So they're supposed to listen up to all the evidence and then give a decision. Then you shall do according to what they declare to you from the place that he who is will choose. By the way, reminder that the Urim and the Thummim was always available as the ultimate mechanism of deciding these things. They were the two stones in the pocket behind the breastplate of the high priest. The high priest evidently would ask a question that could be answered in one of two ways, either yes or no, or this thing or that thing. And whichever stone, I think, glowed, that was God's supernatural answer. And so that was the ultimate appeal for him. Verse number 11, according to the instructions that they give you, and according to the decision which they pronounced to you, you shall do. So whatever the ultimate authority in this chain of authority says, that's what you're supposed to adhere to. You shall not turn aside from the verdict that they declare to you, either to the right hand or to the left. And the reason for this is made clear in verse 12. The man who acts presumptuously by not obeying the priest who stands to minister there before he who is your God or the judge, that man shall die. Because you see, that is basically sedition. If you refuse to do what the supreme authority of the land says, that is sedition. That is rebellion. And that is a capital crime in the theocracy of Israel, because you are standing against God. There's actually a little bit of an echo of that in the Romans 13 passage that you might be familiar with. Let me just read the beginning of it to you, where it says, "Let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment." So the principle was, you've got multiple tiers within the government trying to take care, according to God's principles, issues that come up over time. But the ultimate appeal is to God himself through the high priest for the Israelis. And if you blow God off, that is a capital crime. So you shall purge the evil from Israel, and all the people shall hear and fear and not act presumptuously again. And if I remember correctly, and I don't know if I can check it so fast. I think it is correct. The word translated by the English Standard Version translators, the literal meaning is to have a high hand, to basically shake your hand at God and say, "You're not the boss of me. I don't have to do what you say. I'll do what I want." And that's never a good attitude. And so if you have a few people that are engaging in that sort of sedition and you take them out by capital punishment, then Moses says, that's going to have a chilling effect on other people engaging in the same sort of sedition. Verse number 14. When you come to the land that he who is your God is giving you, and you possess it, and you dwell in it. And so remember, Moses talking to his students of 40 years, telling them, you're going to be going into the promised land here briefly, very shortly, right after I die. When you get in there, eventually something's going to happen that I want to give you rules for. Here it comes. And there you say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me. And that's almost the exact words that happen in the story of King Saul. That Israel says, Samuel, we want a king. Give us a king over us like all the nations around us have. And so here is Moses, several hundred years before that, saying, when you come up into the land and you begin to have that sort of attitude, then, yes, verse 15, you may indeed set a king over you. So here is permission that will be allowed. Whom he who is your God will choose. So that's the caveat. Yes, eventually you'll want a king, but here you better understand only king that you should have is one that God approves of. Now here's some of the things about him. One from among your brothers you shall set up as king over you. You shall not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Meaning, the king must be an Israeli. Cannot be a non-Israeli. Verse 16. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since he who is has said to you, you shall never return that way again. Horses were the high-tech weapon system, the mobile weapon system of that day. You could ride on a horseback with bow and arrow and do a lot of damage very quickly. Or you could hook some horses up with a chariot, and you got a very highly effective mobile death platform. And so horses represent human military might. And God does not want the king of Israel to represent human military might. He's supposed to represent God. Verse number 17, and he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. So two other issues. Wives for kings were typically taken as the seal of some sort of agreement between nations, between countries. And so multiple wives represented political alliances and power. And God wants the Israelis to understand that is not going to be your power base. It shouldn't be political alliances. And neither should wealth, because that's silver and gold, right? So the leader of Israel, the king of Israel that eventually comes into play, should not be someone who leans heavily on human military might or on political connections to other people groups through marriages, treaty marriages, nor should he be super, super wealthy as his power base. Every last one of those began to be broken by first David a little bit, and then definitely King Solomon. They multiplied horses to themselves, chariots to themselves. In fact, Solomon actually went to Egypt and got their high-speed weapons platform chariots to add to his kingdom to make himself very powerful. That was a no-no. He also married multiple wives from countries and regions around him to really bump up his political alliance power. He was married to 300 full wives, meaning those wives had certain rights, including that of having children by him. They were probably princesses from other countries. And then 700 concubines, which would have been from minor, and we're going to use that in quotes, minor political alliances. And those ladies came without some of those big-time rights, such as having an heir with King Solomon. And so that was a big no-no, and he blew that up. And, of course, that also cost him his eternal life, I think, because those pagan foreign wives turned his heart away from God. He even worshiped with them. And this was part of the warning, is that they'll turn your heart away from me, God says. And then the silver and the gold, that was definitely something of the David and definitely something of the Solomonic time of rule, is they became super, super wealthy. And that became a trap leading into sin for later parts of the Solomonic kingdom, the Davidic and Solomonic kingdom. So here is Moses trying to impress upon the Israelis of his day, there are going to be rules to avoid the king leading you away from God, from leading you away from trust in the true king of Israel. Don't let it happen. Now, next session, we will talk about the other rules that he gives to try to help keep the human king on track and not fall into these traps.